Hi, this is Chris Wilson, and this is Messing Around in Cars. Thanks for listening. Today, I'm just going to really finish off my personal Goodwood journey from ultimately making my debut in 2012 in the Whitson Trophy in the GT40 after a 14-year period from first seeing Goodwood in 98 through to last year in 2019, being able to share my car with André Lotterer, the 65 AC Cobra, and win the RAC TD Celebration, probably the single biggest race in the historic racing calendar, again at Goodwood on the biggest stage there is. And I guess what I just want to do is rattle through the following, that seven-year period between debut and being able to run at the front and try and share with you some kind of sense of what it took, what was involved, and how we got there. So, as I said, I guess the starting point from this one is 2012, where, having been focused almost solely on getting to Goodwood for so many years, I'd now achieved what had been until that point a big goal of mine, made the debut, not made an arse of myself, finished safely, got an okay finish, and climbed that mountain. And afterwards, going back to Oz, it felt a little bit like a bit of anticlimax, if I'm honest with you. There was nothing locally to where I was living there to even compare with Goodwood, let alone some of the other major events that go on in the UK and Europe. I raced at Phillip Island. I continued racing locally in Oz at Barbagello. And the following year in 2013, with business and family and other commitments, I wasn't able to travel overseas again, and just continued racing locally, which is great fun, but it wasn't really satisfying the urge to go and experience something else. And I guess also for me, I was coming around to the conclusion that for me, the racing was more a little bit of big game hunting. I love just messing around in cars, as the name of the podcast suggests. But I love the racing. But there comes a point when you're racing in mixed grids and you're challenging for not challenging for outright wins, but just playing in class and everything else, that for me, I wasn't necessarily getting the reward ratio right. You're racing, let's face it, it's expensive, whatever level you do. And if you're not coming away from it all thinking, I'm really happy with what I'm getting out of what I'm putting into this, then you've got to question why you're doing it. And I wanted to go and tick some of these big boxes, these events I'd read about in the magazines and watched the videos of and heard about. But until that point, I'd only ever dreamed about. So 2014, I geared up again to go and make a couple more forays outside of Australia to try and experience some of these big events. And had to plan them way in advance for all the obvious reasons, family and work and other commitments and travel, given where I was living. And the first that year, I did Tour Auto for the first time, again in the GT40, which was an amazing event, and I'll cover in a separate podcast at a date. And then I also entered, at the end of that year, the inaugural Daytona 24-hour, which again was a fantastic experience. And I took two cars there, the GT40 again, and I also had a 74 Porsche 911 3-liter RSR, fabulous history car, the Cafe Mexicana car that I'd bought in of a chap in Pittsburgh, and had David Hinton, who runs Heritage Motorsports in Florida and who also runs HSR, that in fact staged the Daytona event. I'd had him restore and prepare for racing for me. And again, huge event. So both of those deserve more coverage in their own right because they are massive boxes to tick. And I have huge and very precious memories from both of them, both exciting, dramatic, highs and lows, everything you expect. Could not recommend them more highly. And like anything, the first time you do these things often leave you with the biggest impression. So I'll cover that in more detail later. In 2015, life changed for us and we decided to move back to the UK. And that started to change everything because now the UK, in many respects, really is the center of racing, whether it's modern racing or historic racing. All the preparers, the tracks, the events are here. Europe's easy access. The US is easy access as well. But really, most of what goes on is in the UK and mainland Europe. And the biggest event for me, again, my return dream is Goodwood. I've been coming back to it. I watched it again as a spectator in 2015 and thought, okay, let's go back again now that we're here. Let's try and improve what I've done before. So rather than just going back and just taking part again, I wanted to start picking up my game and seeing if I could do better there. So rather than just being a participant, be a competitor is probably the best way of describing it. So in 2016, I started this journey now where I thought, look, I've got to invest in two things now, not only just the car and the events, but also me as a driver. And that's probably when I first started to really think about driver coaching, which is something that is, I would advise any budding amateur, whether it's just at my level or somebody looking to make a professional career out of it, to take on board earlier rather than later. Because as someone, you know, tongue-in-cheek said to me, you know, the biggest area for improvement is the nut behind the wheel. And again, it's important to find someone you can work with. And through a number of, you know, contacts and people, I was introduced to Sam Hancock, who's been around the sport for years. He's raced everything, modern cars, historic cars, a winner in many categories in many different disciplines, and an amazing driver coach. And I think the key part for me, I said before, is it's really important to gel with someone because you're putting huge trust in them and they're also putting huge trust in you. And I think in those initial few times when you're going out, you're both trying to weigh up whether or not it works for one another. And I think what I liked about Sam is he's very, very good in historic cars, has got great mechanical sympathy, is a regular competitor at Goodwood, which again is important for me, and a multiple winner at Goodwood in different cars and different races. And that parlayed itself into big leaps in confidence for me, where I could start to relax in the car more. And he introduced me to concepts that to this day are at the bedrock of how I race, you know, trying to keep a flat platform, trust in the lateral grip in the car, thinking about rate transfer a lot more, thinking about tire scrub, thinking about carrying speed, thinking about the brake not only as a braking device, but as a weight transfer control device. It introduced me to using data, so we started using a V-box so we could really sit down and analyze his times and performance over the circuit and my time. And that enables me as a pupil really to make very dramatic gains very quickly, because you instantly see where you're losing a second and a half in a corner, and you can see where someone else is braking. And then literally the next time you get back in the car, you go, well, I know the car can do it. I know it's safe. And you just make these big gains. So suddenly I move from probably chipping away, you know, tenths of a second just through dogged persistence through to half or three quarters of a second in a day very, very quickly. And that all adds up obviously over the circuit. So with that, I went into my second Goodwood race, which was 2016, back in the Whitson Trophy again, in the GT40, in a far better frame of mind. And I needed that, because in 2014, I went back, or 2016, I went back, and that year it was very wet. And I think I mentioned last time around that one of my big fears for Goodwood was it being a wet race, because as we know, it's a very fast circuit. It's got, it's very unforgiving. It's surrounded by grass and grass banks without the runoff areas of the bigger Grand Prix circuits. If you have an accident there, it's generally going to be a big one, unless you're very lucky. And the Whitson Trophy, whilst driver standards were improving, it was still renowned as being, you know, the fastest race of the weekend in big banger sports cars, which have, they've typically got big power, lots of torque, and you combine those two things on a wet track, and it can get very interesting, very hairy, very quickly. So again, that was a baptism of fire for me, but I went out qualified well again, where I wanted to be, finished the race in a pretty instant filled race, but I'd improved. I finished 11th. So again, not challenging anyone for, you know, putting any other front runners under any kind of pressure, but you picked up two more places from a 13th place finish back in 2012. But I think what really then came through was I thought, okay, I can do this. And that was a realization. I can race in the wet, I can race in the dry. I'm getting a feeling for what's involved here now. And I now know what I need to do to improve. I also realized that the other thing I wanted to do was to try and get another car, because with racing any of these major events, the time and commitment is significant. And when you're there for 3 days, or in the case of Goodwood, you're bumping in on the Thursday, qualifying on a Friday, and you've got racing Saturday or Sunday. If you can run two cars there, obviously, you start to get some economies of scale coming as well. And equally, you get more time out, because you're going there with your race head, but rather than one 15-minute quali session and one 25-minute race or 20-minute race, you then got two qualies and two races. So you just get more time, simple as that, more seat time. And that can translate into more confidence, and that confidence can translate into better results. So I thought, okay, what do I want to do now? I want to think about finding another car as well. And that's where I thought, well, okay, if I'm going to really go this, what other race at Goodwood on the Goodwood race card would I like to be part of? And the one I set my mind on was the TT, which has been, you know, Goodwood themselves bill it as the jewel in the crown. It's, you know, it, back in the period in the 60s, the TT was held at Goodwood. And the TT is a hugely historic race. You know, it's the RAC Tourist Trophy. It's the longest and oldest running continuous trophy in British motorsport. And some of the names on that TT trophy from, you know, the likes of obviously Moss and Hill back to you know, Nuvolari in earlier days, it's got some incredible history behind it. And when the revival was introduced in 1998, the first 98 meeting was the RAC TT celebration, which is a 1 hour race for, you know, sports cars of a type, a 465, a two driver race. It makes it very exciting to have a driver change in the middle of it. And again, for me, it's always been about sports cars and GT cars, not open wheelers. I don't really have a passion for pre-war. And again, saloon cars, again, have never really been something that fired my imagination or my passion up. So I started looking for a car to run in the TT. And again, if you want to have a competitive car in the TT, there's a couple of obvious choices. You know, the glamour cars are the Ferraris, the GTOs, and the short wheelbases, and maybe the Aston Martin DB4 GTs. But these are all hugely valuable cars, even in 2016 and you know, more so now. But not only that, they're not really competitive. The game's moved on. The, you know, the kind of front-running, you know, weapon of choice, for want of a phrase, is either a lightweight E-type Jaguar or an AC Cobra. You know, great protagonists in the day and great protagonists now. And I've always liked my V8s. You know, it's a simple thing. I love the way they sound. I'm used to them in the GT40. I've always loved the Cobra as a car. I had a big block car back in 2007, which I'll perhaps ramble on about some other day, but I loved that car. Did a lot of miles in it in some European rallies, but you need a 289 Cobra. And so I went out, you know, having, you know, finished the Goodwood race, knowing this is my plan, started looking for a car. And one of the truisms of historic racing and the whole historic car world is, I think Nick Mason put it rather well in his book, you know, I think Into the Red, I think it was, where he says it starts, there's this kind of uneasy friendship between the dealers, or the hunter and the hunted, I think he called it. Because unlike buying a new car, where you might have a relationship with your local dealership, with historic cars, you never know who's going to have the car you want for sale. And once you've bought and sold more than one car, you will inevitably start to deal with more than one dealer out there. And there's a whole array of people out there trying to consign cars, because again, most of these cars are consigned to a dealership or to one of the historic dealers. They very rarely own the stock. So they're typically brokering the deals between a buyer and a seller. And you become friends with these, you know, these guys. So a lot of my friends these days are also very much the dealers I've met along the way. So you have this relationship where they're always tempting you with some car you've heard about, or something they've got that might be available, might not be available, or the phone call they've got someone who's really keen on buying the car, one of the cars you've got, and would you be interested in selling? You know, the good ones are very good at trying to put deals together. And you build these relationships. You know that ultimately for them, it's their livelihood, but equally, almost all of them do it because they're passionate, and because we share the same passion, you have a bond as well. So, say, I think, you know, Nick referred to it, there's this relationship in the hunter and the hunted, but it works, and you become very good friends with these guys. And anyway, this, I digress a little bit, but the car I ended up buying, I bought through William Iansen, based in the Cotswolds. And I'd known Will for a number of years and met him on various events and traveled around with him, and we got on very, very well. And he had this fabulous AC Cobra came up for sale. And for me, it just had a good look about it. I remember seeing the pictures went up on the web and I thought, that just looks like a tough car. didn't have any period race history, which typically does have a factor on value. So if you've got two cars like for like and one's got great period history, maybe it's 20-25% more valuable. If it's got really good history like Le Mans and maybe a win on it, it could be multiples more valuable. Anyway, this car was a really honest English car as well, which I liked, a COB Cobra of Britain car rather than CSX, so right-hand drive. And again, the colours I liked, it's a light blue, which is called Princess Alice Blue, and a very British colour. And I've got two daughters, and they kind of like the idea of something that's called Princess Alice Blue. It just kind of worked for me, and as usually is the case, we ended up figuring out how to do a deal, and I had a part exchange at the time, and eventually over the period of probably a month or two, we ended up at an arrangement where I part exchanged a car, and he found someone for that, and I took the Cobra on, and got into the Cobra. And again, it's worth digressing a bit here, because when I bought the GT40 back in 2009, I bought it, as I said at the time, the dealer involved in brokering that sale was Lee Maxted Page. The car was owned by Ray Bilm. Lee had the consignment. But the car had been running at the very front. It was being prepared by Lanzanti, who to this day look after that car and run it impeccably. And therefore, it genuinely was on the button and ready to go. So I was able to hop in it and run it and just carry on from where Ray left off. What I've since discovered over the years is that's an unusual situation. And normally when someone says a car's on the button, particularly a competition or race car, you need to, I think, proceed on the basis that that's in serious question, because I've normally always found that someone's version of on the button is clearly a very different button to the one I'm thinking about. And you know, I've hopped in a car and gone, you know, I don't know what they're thinking, but this is nowhere near it. And whether it's engine hours or gearbox hours or when it was last properly overhauled and tested, or their perception of what an on-the-button car is, and mine was different. But generally, I would counsel anybody thinking about buying a race car to normally always assume the worst and assume it will need everything doing to get it to the state you want. But that's certainly my experience. I'd bought this Cobra, and it wasn't quite that bad because the car hadn't raced for a number of years. This was 2016, and I think the car had last had a serious overhaul in sort of 2008, 2009. And it hadn't really done a lot of use or serious competition since then. It had participated in a lot of events. It had done the Spa 6 Hours. It had done Tor Auto. It ran in Tor Britannia. A chap called Bill Bridges had it for a long time, very well known in the scene, and he'd done a lot of rallying in it and racing, hugely enjoyed it. It had a proper prep, say late 2008 or 9, and then hadn't really done a lot. And the game in historic racing has moved on significantly. And I don't use the phrase arms race lightly, but it is becoming a bit of an arms race. And to be frank, if you want to run at the front and you're not running a current spec engine and you haven't done the proper development on the chassis and the suspension, the setup, you're simply going to, you won't be in the same race as the front running cars. And so I decided that, big intake of breath, I bought this Cobra. Again, it was a very expensive car in anyone's books at the time I bought it. And then I had to decide to embark on a full overhaul. And for a number of reasons, I was running another car with a firm at the time called Ian Gwynn and BGM Sport in Brackley. And again, I wanted to be more involved in it. I think Dean Lanzanti at the time was very heavily involved in some other projects. And we couldn't embark upon taking the Cobra on at the same time. So I decided to try somebody else. Ian had done a great job with me on a 308 Ferrari Michelotto we'd rebuilt and competed in quite successfully, which again, I'll cover some other time. And equally also, Sam Hancock was involved in helping me choose the direction we went in. So he stripped the car, and really the remit was to take it apart and rebuild it with the potential to be a front-running Cobra, and with the aim being to run it in the TT at Goodwood, which was my new goal for that car, obviously. And this was a big project. So the first thing Ian did, we just took everything out of it, all the running gear out, the engine out, took the chassis right back to go and address some issues in the chassis, and also engaged the service at that point of a chap called Nigel Rees from Global Sports Development, who's very well known in the field for chassis development. He came and took all the critical measurements. And one of the things, again, about the Cobra that's worth knowing and makes it easier than some cars is it's a very well understood car these days. There's a lot of people running them. They've been running them successfully for many, many years. And there's a lot of the sort of the blind alleys and their likes have been ruled out, and people know what needs to be done and what's good and what's bad and what's indifferent on them. So you're buying in all that knowledge to save yourself a long and painful process. And out of that process, Nigel came up with a whole heap of recommendations in terms of angles and suspension and bump stops and steering and everything else, to such that we could ensure we were building it back into a zone where it would be comparable with other similar front-running and well-developed cars. The other key part, of course, of choice is engine. And when I bought the car, the engine that was in it was one that had been developed by Pete Knight, Racing Services. And Pete Knight is probably one of the two or three go-to guys in this country. There's Pete Knight, Steve Warrior, and there's a couple of others. But they're probably, between Pete and Steve, probably providing the majority of the front-running V8 engines being used out there. So I went to Pete and basically bought a new engine. I think it's better to start with a completely new engine than to try and disassemble and rebuild something else. And equally, it's quite nice having a spare engine anyway sometimes. But the old engine was no longer where we needed to be. I think we dynoed it. It was producing about 380 brake horsepower, whereas the current spec engines now, you're getting probably 420 to 440, which is a quantum difference. It also meant I wanted to end up in a baseline where I had a car where everything was fresh and I was in a good space to then go forwards with. So we went through that. We went through a whole heap of stuff to make sure the car was safe and up to spec. And with the engine, you've got to do the exhausts. And one thing inevitably leads to another. And it becomes a very time-consuming and expensive exercise. Also, when I bought the car, it didn't have a hard top. It only run without a top beforehand. And the TT is a race for closed cockpit sports cars. So as you see, any of the cars there are either closed cockpit cars or ones running removable hard tops. Small point for me, most of the Cobras out there run the traditional, what I call the Le Mans fastback look, which I think is a really attractive look to the car. It gives the car this fastback profile. But equally, I wanted my car just to be a little bit different. And so I went for the sort of smaller, what they call the bubble roof, which also has the added, it has pros and cons again, bizarrely. And one of the pros is that it leaves you, the boot area itself is unimpinged, so you'd have to change the boot to this split boot access. But the other problem, it does mean the access to the fuel fill is restricted. And to do that without making serious modifications or ugly modifications is hard work. So we then generally accept that running it with a bubble top, you're going to have to fuel the car from within the boot area. But other than that, that was my decision there. Beyond that, the other part of my remit that I think is just key to mention is I believe in, I take tremendous joy, I should say, really, in running original cars. And so all the cars I've owned and own and try and run, I like to run original cars, but prepared to be hopefully competitive in contemporary historic racing. A small thing on the Cobra there is that back in period, the Cobras only ever ran with typically a roll hoop behind the driver. As I also wanted to do some tours in the car, we went down the same route, but I made my roll hoop one that goes across both driver and passenger seat so that you get obviously safety across the two of you when you're on a tour rather than just safety behind you. But I think more over the point, I specifically did not want to go for a full cage, which a lot of the Cobras are running these days. And it's a personal view, and there's no right or wrong on this, because some people will say safety is paramount. And I agree, safety is very, very important. But if I'd bought a C-type Jaguar, they never ran with any kind of rollover protection. And I think if you're running that period of car, you prepare the car as professionally and safely as possible. But to run a C-type Jaguar with some kind of full cage arrangement to me would be wrong. So yes, you could argue it's superior safety, but to my mind, it detracts from the purity of that car. And if you're driving a car like that, you should drive it mindful of the fact that there's a different level of risk involved. So again, for me with the Cobra, I'm very happy to have the rear roll hoop in there, but I did not want a full cage in the car because A, they never ran like that in period. And also B, part of me thinks, and maybe it's the cynic in me, but there's a lot of Cobras running, as we all know, that are not real cars and have been built to just try and be outright front running cars. And if you put a full cage in, the side benefit or the twin benefit as greater safety is a much stiffer car. And there's a lot of things people do to make their car stiffer. But again, I just feel, and it's only a personal view, that I wanted the car to be faithful to how they ran, but prepared to the level of professionalism that we run today. So again, that's a minor but personal choice. So the process of restoration now, I guess, we had the direction, we had an objective in mind, which is the TT. We knew we wanted to try and build a front-running car. The kind of wasn't really a budget because as anyone who's done a restoration will know, and I'll probably elaborate on restorations more in another episode, is they are a bit open-ended. You can have a ballpark figure in mind, but it is almost inevitably always more expensive than you think. And then the other piece that people perhaps don't factor in, and possibly more relevant in race cars, is that it's one thing to do all the initial work. You've then got to go and test it. And on the back of that testing, there's inevitably more development that comes out of it. And that testing, again, still costs time and money to develop that process. So I think, to try and put it in some kind of context around it, from buying the car, and I think I bought it, would have been November 2016. It was then we were all hands on deck. We knew we were aiming for 2017 TT, which is 2017, you know, less than a year away. It was probably 6 months of flat out work, and we spent probably somewhere in the region of £150,000 on the car. That would be including VAT, and just to get the car out there. And then there was probably another £20,000-£30,000 in subsequent development and testing and other bits and pieces. So it's a seriously not insignificant sum of money. And you know, a big factor is always labor. And you can't ever underestimate the amount of time it takes to do something right. And to me, it's a hackneyed phrase, and I've heard it before, but so often you'll hear, you know, races are won or lost in the workshop. And it's very easy to find lots of areas where you can cut time out, but it can come back to haunt you. And there's so many times when you see cars they've pulled over, and it's because of problems that could have been resolved, could have been addressed with a bit more time, effort, and thought beforehand. So I just think if you're going to do a job properly, you do it properly. You don't try and cut corners, but particularly with old, fast, and dangerous race cars. So we went through this process of getting the car built, as I mentioned, and then as it all came back together again in the spring of 2017, we embarked on the testing program. And for that program, again, I employed the services of Sam Hancock again, because I needed someone who could genuinely test the car and drive it well and provide good feedback to see where we were going. And we found a lot of things were still not quite in the window they needed to be. We could look at the lap times and what other well-known competitive cars were achieving. And most of our testing was at Silverstone at the time. And Sam would come back and sort of feed back into the mechanics, damper settings and rebound and thoughts about oversteer, understeer, etc. And we could dial those things out. And we went through an iterative process of stepping the car forward. And then once we had the car in a zone, the focus then changed from developing the car. And by definition, we now moved into developing me, because I knew that I needed to move on as a driver. I was very comfortable in 911s, very comfortable now in the GT40. But I was not comfortable with the Cobra. It was new for me entirely. And yeah, it's obvious to say the main reason, of course, is the Cobra's a front engine car. And I'd only been driving rear engine and mid-engine cars until that point. And it requires a very different technique to get the Cobra to go fast. It's also a much more agricultural car. again, to put it in perspective, the Cobra is a design that probably dates back to the 40s, whereas the 911 is a later design, but an incredibly strong central tub. And the cars I've been driving, later models, 74 RS replica through to the Cup cars and other bits and pieces, were very well developed race cars. And the GT40, again, whilst it's the same year as my Cobra, both were built in 1965, it was representative of the absolute pinnacle of what could be achieved at that time. We've all seen the program now, the movie Ford versus Ferrari, and it's evident that Ford had an open checkbook to develop what was at the time the best race car they possibly could. So you've got, by contrast, one car that represents the absolute pinnacle of what was possible in 1965. And at the other extreme, you've got the Cobra, which was an example of a car that had been developed beyond anything the original designers ever thought, and was at the very end of its useful life as a race car in 1965. And the main way that manifests itself is the car just simply twists and flexes a lot. It's clearly a roadster chassis. It hasn't got that torsional rigidity in the car. You've got a heavy front end. You've got a lot of power and grunt and torque going through the car. And as a result, the car twists a lot. It's a short chassis. Therefore, you've got to drive around the inherent pros and cons that gives you as a car. And I think it's hard to describe what it means, but I just found that I was struggling to get the car to go quickly, easily. And I would come out of it describing it a bit like wrestling a good mate of yours. You grab it by the scruff of the neck. You're all rolling around on the floor, wrestling away. And you'll probably all be okay. If you don't grab it by the scruff of the neck, it's going to accidentally bite and hurt you. And to get it to go fast, you've got to get on top of those characteristics. And the way that works in a Cobra is as you turn into a corner, you've got to get the weight forward to get the front end to bite and turn in. And then you've got to very quickly transition to get the car to rotate round. So the back's coming round now, so the car's sliding, and you're back on the power to squat the back and to get the weight transfer back in the car now and the grip onto the rear tires to drive you through, round and out of the corner. And to go fast, you are sliding the car. And in doing that, of course, the car's loading up and twisting hugely, which is why you often see Cobras with one of the front wheels cocked up in the air, because the whole car is just winding itself up underneath, and you can feel it all straining, and it just this tension in the car all the time. That if you get it one, wants to suddenly be released and spin you off. And I found this incredibly difficult because to this day, I can still hear Sam saying, you've got to just trust the lateral grip. You've got to trust the lateral grip. To go fast, the car's got to be sliding. And that transition from turning, the early phase of turning the car into the rotation, the back sliding and then settling to where you've got it settled and then powering through. I had this momentary lapse. I needed to feel it somehow settle through my bum first before I could get back on the power with confidence or put my foot right into it and drive the car out. And I could see that in the data. I could see it in the lap times. I could see it in the V-box stuff we were looking at. And I was struggling to get there. But my lap times were getting down into what I call a respectable window. But every time I got out of the car, I just felt like I was somehow dancing on thin ice and walking a very fine line between going fast and having an accident. And I found it, as a result, a very stressful car to drive. That aside, I had that program going on with the Cobra. This was also a big year because you just need seat time. So I'd entered the members meeting earlier in the year with the GT40, and that didn't happen. It was a bit of a long story, but we got to it. I was testing the GT40 in February and March, got to the meeting. I had terrible food poisoning. And as a result, once again, picked up the phone of Sam and said, look, I've got an entry. The car's there. I just am in no state to drive this weekend. Do you mind taking the wheel? And if you're not got anything else to race, and see what you can do. And I'll digress a bit, actually, because I think it's worth sharing this for a moment, because up until that point and since, I'm still at the stage where my racing is about doing it myself. But I had that experience that weekend of what I can only imagine it must be like for the owner of a racehorse. Not many owners I know, not that I know many owners, but you would be capable of riding a racehorse. You employ jockeys, clearly. And so that's what it was for me. I was there that weekend watching a very fast driver in Sam race my car. I had family and friends with me. We were in the Jackie Stewart Pavilion that weekend watching. I felt a lot better, actually, just by having the stress removed now from having to, you know, I mean, winding myself up to the race meeting and then not feeling well at all. And you remove the stress and suddenly I felt incrementally better. And it was hugely enjoyable to watch. And Sam did a brilliant job, qualified fifth, had a wonderful battle with James Cottingham in another GT40. Eventually got past him into Lavant corner and was off chasing the load of T70s, I think, at the front. Was winding them in, having a great battle and really closing on second place when the flag dropped. He came home with a podium, which is great. You get the medals, the trophies, the great hall announcement at the end of it, a bottle of beer, which is what it's all about. And in the process, one of the things Sam had achieved, actually, it was a cooler day and the cars run quicker in the cool air, but it was dry. Obviously, the track was rubbering up at the end of the day. And he achieved then what is still to this day the fastest official lap time of a GT40 at Goodwood. He got a 1 minute, 20 seconds, 0.883 lap, which is, it's the fastest ever recorded official race lap of a GT40. So huge congratulations. And again, proof if more was needed that I was teamed up with the right driver, coach and driver, and also in Lanzante, the right guys to prepare and run that car. You both had performed flawlessly. So we left the members meeting. I had also entered Mondo Centauro that year, which is a mega event. And I'll cover Mondo Centauro and Toro Auto in a later episode because they're both great events, a combination of special stages, against the clock on closed road sections and races. So in the process of preparing for Mondo Centauro and then competing in that, I was getting a lot more seat time again in race cars throughout that period. And then we had the summer again of testing both the GT40, I mean, I was in the zone for that again for the Whitson. And I was ready with the Cobra for the TT in that year's Goodwood Revival. So by the time September came round, I was probably as well prepared as I could be. But one of the key things, of course, here is in the TT, it's a two-driver race, which is obvious. So you need a co-driver. And about probably 3 or 4 months beforehand, I was thinking, okay, well, who am I going to drive with? I think Sam was otherwise committed, and I needed somebody else who was, I could trust, who had mechanical sympathy, who I was going to get along with, who knew Goodwood, who knew the rules of engagement at Goodwood, and so on and so forth. And a series of phone calls and conversations, and the long and short of it, I ended up partnering up with Gregor Fiskin. Now, Gregor's a good mate, and again, I'd met him through doing a bit of business. I think he'd sold a couple of cars for me beforehand. Over the years, there's a few things I'd looked at that he had for sale that hadn't, for one reason or another, come to pass. But we got to know one another. And he's a very accomplished driver. I mean, he's amateur rather than professional, but has raced everything from modern GTs to pre-war and everything in between. Competed at Le Mans multiple times. Been probably almost every Goodwood Revival there's been, competed all around the world in just about everything, in all the great cars you can think of, from Formula One cars to Ferrari 250 GTOs. He's one of the most accomplished all-round drivers out there, I think, who's not full-time professional. So for me, it was a real honor and a privilege to share the car with Gregor. And again, it starts to put the pressure on, because I knew Gregor's faster than me. I know Gregor's got a reputation. You don't want to sully that reputation, and you want to be able to add to it and have a good weekend together. Equally, the trust goes the other way. He's trusting me to bring a good, well-prepared, safe car to the race meeting and trusting me to do a good job as a co-driver. And you're given normally the owner starts. You want to be able to hand over a car that's in good order for the second half of the race. Anyway, we did some tests together. We got along in the testing. Gregor was, as expected, faster than me and brought, again, a lot of experience. And also he brought a lot of, I guess, strategic thinking as well, because he'd done many TTs before. He was able to talk me through scenarios and tactics and pros and cons and what might be a good idea, what probably isn't a good idea, and so on and so forth. So I guess the long and short of it is, when we got to September, I was very well prepared. I'd been in and out of race cars since February that year, had done a lot of testing, wet and dry, in both cars I was racing that weekend and another car, which I'd run in Modena Centauro. And so the first time felt, we're here now to be able to possibly, try and make a mark. And I'd set myself a goal of, if we could try and get, maybe a top 10 finish in the TT would be something nice to aim for. And I think, again, with the TT, I didn't feel it's overly ambitious because the attrition rate in that race is normally pretty high. So if you can be, moderately quick, keep your nose clean, have a reliable, well-prepared car and get to the end, you've got a fairly good chance. And the Cobra's a fast car. So I thought, we should be in the zone for possibly, if all the stars aligned, maybe a top 10 finish wasn't out of the realms of possibility. So come the weekend, it was worth noting, we qualified both cars on the Friday, the GT40 I was doing myself, and I did the joint quali session on the Friday for the Cobra. And on the Saturday, we did the second qualifying two with the Cobra. And I think we put it on 14th of the grid, 12th, 13th, 14th, somewhere around there. I can't remember without looking the details up. But we were midfield, but we were fundamentally happy that we're out there, we're safe, we're ready to go. And again, for me, it was also a process because I get very, very wound up before a race. I put myself under a lot of pressure to try and perform properly and try not to take anything for granted. And the TT has a reputation. It is fast and furious. It's a race everyone wants to win. There's everything at stake. There's some big egos out there. There's some very fast drivers. As the years have progressed from 98 till to date, the mix of drivers on the field has only got more and more and more professional, with numerous guys in there as guest drivers, share drivers, who have been competing at the highest levels in Formula One or sports cars or other disciplines. And so you've got guys in there who are still current professionals and works drivers in various teams, or there's many drivers in there who are what I call semi-works drivers for the bigger historic race teams. So these guys are driving every other weekend in all manner of cars. So you've got a very, very, very competent, very well qualified, very fast field of drivers, all of whom are very keen for a win, because the TT is a big, big box to tick and a win to have if you are a competitive historic racing driver. So come the race, as I said earlier, as Gregor suggested, I decided to take the start because, again, you never know if the car's going to run. So you want that, what they call owner's right to a degree, to at least experience it. And so I got strapped into the car and we got to the grid and all the shenanigans that precede that. And as I was on the grid, though, and Ian, the guy's doing the final checks, and you're just double-checking your seatbelts before the green flag lap, I remember this feeling, looking at the crowds around you. It was the crowds were, it was packed. It always draws everybody out to watch the start. So the whole way around the circuit, it would be 10 people deep, and all the grandstands are full as they count down to the start of the TT. And then off you go for the green flag lap. You come around, grid up, and you're waiting for the flag, which I've mentioned before is a unique thing at Goodwood. But when you're sort of sitting, six, seven rows back, you kind of got an eye on two things. You've got your eye on the flag, but you're very conscious of your periphery vision being the cars in front of you, because it's not uncommon for cars to stall or have slow starts. So as the flag drops, again, I was very conscious of giving it more revs rather than less. I'd rather have wheel spin than bogging the car down. And then as you see the flag drop with your conscious eyesight, you're instantly getting your foot into it and looking ahead to see what the cars in front are doing to make sure you're not going to rear end someone, which can happen very easily and cause all manner of drama. And you hair off. You've got the car at this point on cold tires, maximum fuel load, therefore maximum weight. And you're into the TT, and our strategy had been that we're going to try and do roughly half and half of the race, so it's an hour race, so you want to change somewhere around the half-hour mark. So we gave ourselves a window of between 25 and 35 minutes, because there's a pit window. And you're relying here on the your team to tell you when to come in, because Goodwood's a very narrow pit lane and it gets very busy in there when there's more than two or three cars in. If you come into it behind a queue of cars or in one of those busy periods, it's very, very easy to lose a lot of time and get seriously held up. So we, you know, we knew what we were aiming for, and quite often you'll see if you've got a team with a slow driver and a fast driver, the slow guy will try and hand over at 20 minutes so the fast guy can do the longer stint. Or which other way around, you'll find the fast driver will hop out at 40 minutes to leave the last 20 to the slower driver. That's the, you know, the absolute, the end points of the pit window itself. But we were going for halfway. So I knew that it somewhere around about 25 minutes onwards, I was going to get light shown an inboard. So that first 20, 25 minutes was probably the longest, most physical 25 minutes I've ever had in a race car, because, as I said, the TT is full on. It is a busy, busy race, very powerful, fast sports cars being driven, sliding, moving around, kicking up dust under intense scrutiny from a knowledgeable crowd. And you want to do well, and you're trying to find that line between not overdriving the car and not going too cautiously and just dropping way back down the field. And I still, as I said earlier, I just didn't really feel at one with the car. I knew I could be in respectable lap times for where I was at that point in time, but it wasn't easy. So it's very, very physical. And I think with the magnitude of the occasion, I was finding it even more physical. I remember just perspiration dripping down the face. I mean, my eyes were stinging. My shoulders felt, you know, very, very tense across them. I had to keep relaxing my hands because I was just gripping the steering wheel too hard. And that, again, caused all manner of problems in terms of delicacy of driving a car quickly. But I was getting into it, and I was just waiting for the inboard. And it seemed to take an age for it to come out. And when eventually I got the inboard and you came in, there's a sense of, thank God for that. I can come in now. You know, I can come in. So you come out of the chicane, pull into the pit lane, you're releasing the belts as you roll to a stop, handing over to Gregor. And then as he goes out, I just kind of felt, that's it. I'm actually happy now. I've done it. I've survived my first TT. I've done my bit. I can now watch it from the wall with the guys, relax and enjoy it and see how it goes. And I think I'd gained a few places whilst running. I think I was running probably 10th or 11th when I came in. We then obviously lost probably four or five places in the pit change, because it still takes a long time to pit and do a driver change there. And then to watch Gregor in the car, and he just got stuck into it. It was fabulous to watch suddenly. And again, I had the same feeling I had with the GT40 earlier in the year. You're watching your car being driven by someone who's better than you and being driven really well. And he was coming back through the field, and he was back up to, I think, you're challenging for 10th or 9th place with a bit serene. I thought, we're on course for our goal here. This might happen. We're going to do this. You know, Gregor's driving well. The sun was shining. Wasn't it wet on the Saturday, but I'll more of that in a moment. I think we're going to get our objective here. But it was frustrating because this race run with a bit serene, it was apparent that had more grunt on the straights. But the Cobra's better under brakes and faster in the corners. And so every time we got the Lavant straight or up towards Madrick or the fast pick at the back of Fordwater, the Bitcherini would stretch away. And then into the corners, Gregor was all over him, but the Bitcherini just had the elbows out very, very wide, and he couldn't get past. And this went on for four or five laps, and you could see the frustration building, and Gregor's, the attitude of the car was moving around, and you knew that if he could get past the Bitcherini, it's probably a second and a half faster, so we could make some serious progress. Anyway, sadly, it didn't come to pass. Coming into the chicane, I think the Bitcherini might have brushed brake tested him slightly, but whatever happened, Gregor had to take avoiding action and brake hard. In the process, clipped the chicane pretty hard in the front right and put the car into a spin on the exit. He gathered it up, got his head down and carried on with the front headlights missing now, crumpled front wing. But again, you'd lost quite a few spaces in that point. And we were back. But he got his head down. Come the flag, though, he came in 12th. And we were overjoyed. I was overjoyed. I went to meet him in the collecting area. Gregor was understandably frustrated and annoyed with himself. But equally, it was no fault of his own. We were doing well. And I think the frustration at the time was behind it. And we've all had situations like that, but we'd had a great race. We'd done well. We hadn't disgraced ourselves in any way. And in a very tight competitive field, had come 12th, which is, you know, which is no bad place to be. So that was my first TT done with the Cobra. I'd done it, ticked that TT box, which, as I'd mentioned earlier, was for me the goal. I'd wanted to do a Goodwood TT. It's the hardest race to get into. It's the most competitive race. It's the highest profile race. I'd done it in a great hero car in the Cobra, and had achieved that goal. It's also worth mentioning how I got on with the GD40. I did the same weekend. I did the Whitson Trophy again, I think now for the third time. And on the Saturday, it was a very wet race. It was very wet, and then the rain stopped just for the side of our race. So it was, and the sun was coming out, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a very wet and greasy track with the sun starting to get a little bit lower in the sky. So it's a bit in your eyes down into Ford Water. And I think I'd qualified the car 7th at the time for that race. Again, I was now solidly in the top 10. But I think one of the benefits that year is Ted, I'd done a lot of wet driving that year, and I started to feel really confident in the car in the wet, and I was very comfortable with that car sliding around underneath me. The long and the short of it is you finished the Whitson Trophy on very challenging conditions, very wet to start with and drying towards the end, and brought it home in 6th place. So I'd now had, I think it's 13th the first time, 11th the second time. And now we had, had a 6th place finish. And more importantly, to my mind, that the people I was benchmarking myself against, or what I would call the other, I'm not sure gentleman driver is the right phrase, but what I call the other serious but occasional participants, guys who love their racing and their cars, but we're not out there all the time doing it, even though we're doing it seriously. But looking at the guys ahead of me there, it was Chris Ward, who's kind of almost a work driver, one of the bigger historic teams at the time, huge experience. Nick Padmore, super accomplished driver. Mike Jordan's the same. Stuart Hall, Aston Martin works driver. And Mike Whittaker, again, is an amateur driver, but again, very, very, very quick and accomplished driver, huge experience there. And then me behind them. And I just thought, well, if these are the guys I'm losing to, I'm happy with that. These guys are out there regularly. They're super fast, years of experience. And I just, I now felt incredibly at home with the GT40. And it's an odd one, but if it's possible to fall in love with the car, I was only falling more in love with it because I could take it out now and really grab that car by the scruff of its neck and do well in the car and for myself. So I guess as we finished 2017, it had been a great year. I really got on top of the GT40. I've got massive seat time under my belt now, done a lot of testing, understood a lot more about how cars work, the different driving styles needed for different cars. And I ticked off that first TT. And that really now started me thinking about, okay, what are we going to do next year? How do we build? How do we go forward from here? Because, as I said, once again, I climbed another mountain, slight sense of anticlimax. What's next? First, a quick footnote to the TT, which I just wanted to relay, really for those who aren't quite as close to historic motorsport as some of us are, in terms of what goes on and the kind of the rules of things behind the scenes. But when one, as an owner, invites someone to share the car, particularly an event like Goodwood, generally the rules are that it's the owner's decision, the owner's choice, and therefore so it's the owner's going to be picking up all the costs to prep the car, run the car and post-race prep afterwards. And if there's any damage throughout his racing incidents and the like, they're going to cover it too. Because clearly a lot of people wouldn't want to accept an invitation if they were hopping into a car that they possibly weren't in a position to contribute towards if needs be. But as I said, we had a bit of damage at the end of the race with the front wing where this bingle with a chicane had happened, which really was a pure racing incident, born of a situation which shouldn't really come about, and therefore it led to some frustration with Gregor because the Bizzarini should have yielded the place after 3 or 4 laps because it was clearly a slower car, and if Gregor could have carried a bit more speed on the straights, he would have been 1.5-2 seconds a lap faster. So it really was a case of being deliberately held up beyond what's reasonable. But I went up to check on the Cobra 4 weeks or so later, just to go through a winter schedule of works with Ian. And the car was sitting there already looking immaculate. The wing was repaired, paint was beautiful. You wouldn't tell it ever had a knock before. And I asked Ian, he said, oh, don't worry, look, Gregor phoned me up and told me just to go ahead and do it and to send him the bill. And I said, well, hang on, that wasn't what I agreed. And really, it shouldn't have happened that way. So I phoned Gregor and said, look, you know, thanks, but you really didn't need to. I don't want you to feel like you had to at all. And we'd agreed on the day that, look, these things happen, I'll cover it. It's just, that's the nature of the game. But the fact that he did just really bears mentioning, because it just speaks volumes about how he goes about his racing and speaks volumes about the majority of the people out there in the historic racing paddock. Even though there are kind of general rules, sometimes if things happen, they happen, and people put their hands up to it. And Gregor just acted like a complete gentleman, had the car fixed. There's no need for it at all. But it is really, really pleasing. And again, just made me feel very lucky to know that I was around the right kind of people, because there certainly are people out there who wouldn't do the same. And there's been plenty of celebrity drivers over the years at Goodwood and other events who've had huge accidents, sometimes in cars with a lot of damage, and have just walked away from it, leaving the owner to pick up the cost and pick up the pieces. So I just wanted to mention that to really show the nature of the people I had around me and generally what goes on in the paddock. But as I say, I digress. So I'd done my TT now. Another kind of feather in the cap, really, another box ticked, another goal achieved in my motor racing, big game hunting, I guess. I'd now done the main event. But it left me, as I got to the end of the year, thinking, right, what next again? The following year, 2018, I was a busy year for me with other work and commitments, and I wasn't able to do as much racing as I'd like to have done. And I did the Modena Centauro that year and the members meeting at the beginning of the year. Both, again, great events, and I'll cover Modena Centauro at a later date, because it's, those are huge fun. A lot of miles in the car, you spend a lot of time with your co-driver, which in my case has always been a good mate. And it really is a proper adventure. But once I'd done that in June, the second half of the year for me was a complete scratch. So I couldn't really build up to anything, and I wasn't really looking to build up to anything. But given I had then that sort of 6 months to think about the racing I'd love to be doing but couldn't, I kind of came to the conclusion that, I wanted to go back and do the TT again, but now give it a red hot shot. Because I felt we'd done well for ourselves, we'd made a good account, and I knew that if I could somehow get on top of the car, there was more speed in me, and that with a reliable car and a good quick driver, we could probably get a good solid top 10 finish, maybe even top 5, which is where I was. Now I knew I could finish in the GT40 in the Whitsun races. So I started to think about this process again, and the main thing on my mind was I needed to get comfortable with the car, because I'd at one point I toyed with selling it, because I thought, this is it's a big, powerful, fast car. And as I've mentioned earlier, I always felt like I was really struggling to stay on top of it, and only a couple of seconds away from a big accident at all times. So I went about another testing schedule, and once again, the call went out to Sam and said, Sam, can you come and help me? I've got to try and get past this. And we were back at Silverstone, back talking about the same things we had before. And you've got to trust the lateral grip, and you've got to let the car slide, and you've got to let it move underneath you. And it was one of those moments, like I remember learning to ski, where it went from sort of snow plow to parallel skiing, and it felt really hard. And then suddenly you're parallel skiing, and you're going, well, hang on, what was all the fuss about? And I was at Silverstone struggling, and it's late morning, just before lunch. And suddenly I made that transition. I committed the car to a corner and committed it straight into the slight oversteer drift that you need to have from turning. And it all felt so easy. And the grip was there. The car was sliding, and it wasn't sliding away from me. I didn't need to wait for it to grip up through my bum. I could just commit straight to it and get back on the power and drive it through. And it was an epiphany. It was like, why was this so hard beforehand? Actually, this car is incredibly balanced. It's got all the power you need. When the car is sliding, you can steer it on the throttle because it's got so much torque. And again, I'd never really experienced throttle steer before, how you could control the angle beautifully just with the throttle. And it suddenly felt so easy. And then off the back of that, in very quick succession, everything became more relaxing. So my shoulders relaxed. I felt mentally more at ease now. Suddenly the physical effort wasn't going into it the same way it was. I could soften my hands off. I could steer with my fingertips. And almost in the course of that afternoon, I suddenly found another 2 seconds a lap, which is huge progress to make when you're already at a level that's pretty competitive. And I thought, okay, we're on the pace now. My lap times are now within a second or so of the other fast amateur drivers. So with that, I thought the TT is on again. We can go now and take this renewed confidence back to Goodwood and see what we can do. So I got in touch with the organisers, got in touch with Matt Hearn and the team early in 2019, said, look, I'd love to compete again. What can we do? Can we perhaps get involved? Are you able to give us any early indications whether we have been accepted or not? And long and short, he came back to me and said, Chris, love to have you here again. And equally, though, we'd love to have you paired up with one of our real name drivers this year. You know, they're always having to find cars for some of the invited superstars that Goodwood invite to drive. I said, well, that's fine. That's, you're more than happy to consider that. But as long as I've got some input into who's driving, so can you perhaps give me a bit of a selection of, or a bit of a flavor of who it will be, so at least I know that I can say, yep, I'm happy that they're going to be someone who can I can share the car with, and they'll be respectful of it and not going to let possibly ego get in the way of doing a good job, etc. And he said, well, okay. They sent me an email about a week later and said, look, you've either got Nicolas Minassin, you've got Romain Dumas, or André Lotterer. And I thought, whoa, this is serious now. These aren't the old guard. These are, you know, proper, current, modern day, and certainly in the case of Dumas and Lotterer, top of their game works drivers. You know, Dumas, Porsche works driver, Lotterer, you know, 3 times Le Mans. I think Dumas, 1 times Le Mans winner. You know, Lotterer this year is in Formula E for Porsche. You know, very, very quick drivers. So a bit of research and a bit of reading, I said, look, if I got a choice, I'd love to pair with André Lotterer. I just, mainly because I'd been aware of a lot of things in social media and magazines that led me to believe he's a real classic car guy too. He understood classic cars. He wasn't just about someone who wanted the latest, greatest modern thing under him to win races. You know, he has some wonderful 911s. He has a wonderful short wheelbase Audi Quattro, which I'd had one similar before and used and enjoyed. And so I felt there's an understanding and a level of respect there. I'd seen him drive before at Goodwood sharing a Cobra in an earlier year. And long short of it, they said, yeah, that's all confirmed. This then really starts to ramp up the pressure. So the usual pressure I put myself under was just taken up a few notches. I think it was Singer said, you know, turn it up to 11 at this point. And I embarked on probably a 4-month program where I did probably 3 or 4 test days, a couple at Silverstone, a couple at Goodwood. I put together a sort of physical training program, which just mainly running, a lot of running and some upper body strength as well, just to make sure I was on the best possible shape I could be to get ready for it. Again, I had Sam with me at the test days, and I just wanted to make sure I got to the point where I knew that I was taking my absolute A game to the event. And Ian and the guys at BGM Sport, I had them go through the car back to front and double check everything, to make sure we had a, you know, fast and safe car that we could have someone like Lotterer hop into with confidence. So we got to September, and the first thing I was really relieved about was it was that year stunning weather all week and all weekend, which removes a level of concern, because I said before, running in the wet there is hairy, and it's always easier mentally when you're going into a dry race. It's one less thing to have to worry about. I met Lotterer for the first time on the Friday, and again, what a lovely chat. We got on, we talked cars. He's clearly passionate, clearly enthusiastic. He wanted to go through the car. He wanted to understand what we'd done with setup. We talked him through all that. And then we came up with our sort of plan of attack for the weekend, which was largely based on, you know, some simple logistics, really. I wasn't able to be at Goodwood on the Saturday that year. So on the Friday qualifying, there's 2 qualifying sessions for the TT. So we agreed that I would do the Friday qualifying and André would do the Saturday qualifying. And then obviously we'd be together for the race. So Friday, again, you've got the qualifying sessions about 20, 25 minutes. And you can do both drivers in there and do a driver change, but it clearly cuts down significantly the time on track. And I just have generally found it's better to get a good session in something where you can someone can really settle into the car, build up time and confidence. And particularly in Andre's case, not having driven the car before, you know, he needs more than 10 minutes to really get the confidence out of it that he needs to know to go quickly. So Friday qualifying, I was under, again, I put myself under a lot of pressure and a lot of self-expectations. I wanted to make a good showing and equally to show to Andre that he wasn't teamed up with someone who was going to make it harder for him. Not that he's there with any expectation, but that they are pairing up with amateurs and they don't know what level we can deliver it necessarily. So I got my head down. The most important part in qualifying is to find space on the track because you're all released in the assembly area, one behind the other, very, very closely. And it's very easy to sort of find you use up all your session and don't get a quick, clean lap in because you just haven't got the space on the track. So I just used the first couple of laps to build a window where I could then start to build pace up and keep a clean track in front of me. And at the end of the session, I came in and I was over the moon. I'd got my own personal best at Goodwood there, a 1:26.064. And I then felt even better when I went and got the results from the driver's lounge, and I found I was fourth fastest. So again, you've got a mixture of owners like myself and the superstar drivers out there on both qualifying sessions. But it's really reassuring to know that I was now fully on the pace. And the people ahead of me on that day had every right to be there, where they were quicker, much vastly more experienced than I was. But I knew I put in a good showing. But equally, I was also aware that normally times get faster on quali two because everyone's just dialing into the weekend at that point and often confidence is building. So I thought, good, strong first showing. Very, very happy with that. And also very happy to be held on to let Andre do the job on Saturday and him knowing that he's got a good co-driver as well. So Saturday came and as I said, I wasn't able to be there. We had a school function of one of my daughters we had to go to. And it was an all-day event, and this had been in the diary for probably 6 months, and you couldn't really get away from it. And I was sitting in this assembly hall at sort of lunchtime, 1 o'clock it was, and we're listening to someone going on about whatever it was they're going on about. My mind was a million miles away at Goodwood mentally. And then my phone started vibrating in my pocket. I look at the phone, and all these text messages started to flood in saying, "You're on pole." And at that point, my heart was in my mouth and I suddenly felt my face go red and I felt my temperature rise, my heartbeat rose. And I was looking through and we got the chance to step outside and I started to look at all these messages and voicemails I was getting from the team and messages from Andre and messages from lots of friends who were down there watching and other mates in the paddock. And not only had Andre put the car on pole on Saturday, he'd done it in a 1:24.073, which is the fastest ever official lap of Goodwood in a Cobra. And that spoke two things to me. One, the quality of the driver. I mean, for someone who's used to modern sports cars, the latest, greatest cars there are by the latest, greatest manufacturers, to hop in an agricultural car like a Cobra on a fast, dangerous circuit like Goodwood and to build up the pace and the confidence to go and put that kind of lap time in was just off the charts. And when I watched it, Goodwood very quickly put up the highlights that afternoon, and I was watching it on my phone again, and the way he carried the speed and the commitment and the drifts through the corners were spectacular to behold. But it did also two things to me. I thought, well, we'd discussed our tactics for Sunday and we'd already agreed that I was going to start the car because even though initially Andre was keen to get in the car and scamper away into a big lead and hand your car over with a big lead, was his theory, which I could then bring home, hopefully, and see how he finished. Experience tells you at Goodwood that if there's going to be an incident, it's normally the beginning of the race. And if you get a safety car, you instantly nullify any advantage big lead gives you. So we just felt it better to play it that I'll go first. And then if there's an incident, it's better. You can manage that. And then you've got the faster driver in to finish the stage. So that was our plan. But so I knew that on Sunday I was going to be starting on pole, and I couldn't focus. And I said to my wife, "That's it. We're not going to go to the ball tonight because I'm just not going to enjoy it. I'm just stressed now to a whole different level." And I was just playing these scenarios in my mind of what we're going to do, how we're going to do it. I'd gone through everything in detail in my mind over the preceding months. I'd probably visualized every possible scenario for wet, dry, cold, back of the grid, front of the grid, different moves every corner. I'd run these different scenarios 1,000 times mentally. I took 2 sleeping tablets to get to sleep on the Saturday night because I just was so wound up. Had a rotten night's sleep, was up very early, drove back to the circuit, and I was there probably at 7 on the track for the track blessing. And I thought, okay, let's just go and check how they're doing the flags this morning, because you know, now I started in the car, Goodwood has a system where they drop the flag. And in all the prior events I've ever done there, it's a very quick up, down with the arm. And so basically you go when you see the arm move, because it's taking maybe a quarter of a second to do that movement, and you can't really get a jump start in that time. So I watched the first race, and there's a different starter. And I noticed she would raise the flag, hold it for about a second and a half, and then drop it. So I thought, oh, that's interesting, and watched the next couple of race starts. And again, I thought, brilliant, that's clearly it. So I now knew I had this in my mind. I had to count to just under 2 seconds and then go to anticipate the flag drop. So I kind of wandered back to the car now, sort of probably 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. And as I got to the car, I saw these bodies all around it, and they're wiring cameras into it and fitting batteries and the like. And I thought, what's going on here? And it turned out it was the Goodwood team strapping in cameras. I said, well, that's great. What are these cameras for? And they said, oh, it's for the live television feed. I said, live television feed? What's that about? He said, no, it's going out live this afternoon on ITV. They're showing the race live. And I didn't know about that. And suddenly I'm thinking, well, I'm sitting here now, starting the car in the biggest grid of the weekend, on pole, and it's going to be live on television. And I just kind of gulped and sat back, and it all started to sink in at this point, the magnitude of what I was about to embark on. And then to add further concern to it, one of the guys came up to me, the mechanics in the car, Chris, and he said, Chris, slight problem in the heat of the action over the course of the 2 quali sessions, we didn't actually remember to go and scrub in the race tires. So you've got your fresh set of tires on for the race this afternoon, but they're not scrubbed in. So on the out lap and then the green flag lap, you need to try and scrub them in and allow all the oils to release from the rubber, etc., and get a bit of and just scrub the tires in, which normally takes 2 or 3 quick laps, and your tires are scrubbed in properly and you're safe to go. When tires are brand new, they're a little bit slippy because they've still got all the release agent in the rubber, which needs to be you need to get rid of that. So I thought, I've now got to think about this as well. And by now your mind's rushing. And I then met with Andre in the paddock again, and we're going through our driver change routine. And little things, one of the great things with my car, it's a COB Cobra, Cobra Britain, which means it's right-hand drive. And the benefit of that at Goodwood is when you come in, it's a very, very tight pit lane, which, again, you've got to get right. But in a right-hand drive car, you're opening the door into the pit wall, which is obviously protected, so you've got more room to get out safely into the driver change, whereas in left-hand drive cars, you're opening the door into the pit lane and other traffic coming through, so it's more dangerous and more difficult to manage. But again, we went through the routines for releasing the seat belts and how we're going to do all that, and I just listened to Andre, because this guy does it for real. And so we agreed our little sequence of how it's all going to work with the mechanics, with me, what my role was in the changeover, what his role was, and who's doing what, so we weren't all fumbling with the belts, which you often see happen. And then finally, the klaxons go, you're called to the assembly area, and on the way from the paddock to the assembly area, there's the crowd at Goodwood that weekend were thousands. It was packed, complete sellout, sunny day, glorious weather. I pulled into the assembly area and drove the car right to the front of the white gates and parked in the number one slot. We then went to the driver briefing, and in the driver's briefing, I came out of that, and kind of Andre slapped me on the back and said, yeah, great, off you go, good luck, and I'll see you at the changeover. And I'm settled into the car, being strapped in by the team now. And again, as I've said before, I can't get in the car straight away, so that I'm not going to get caught up in a rush to get away. Particularly now, I'm going to be the lead car out behind the course cars. And I'm sitting in the car, conscious that all around us there's thousands of people watching, 10 deep around the assembly area, TV cameras walking up and down, the assembly area itself as well. I had a camera in my car that was live. But then one of those moments, Dario Franchitti came in front of the car. I'm going, Jesus, you know, these guys are still my superstars, the guys I look up to and I follow. And he just gave me the big thumbs up and, you know, go on, Chris, go for it, give it your best shot. And, you know, we'll see you out, that type of thing. Because he was sharing with Gregor, actually, in 39PH, another really, really famous Cobra. And then we got pulled out behind the course cars onto the lap out to the assembly lap. And I was just wildly wiggling the car from side to side, lighting the rear wheels up at every opportunity, just trying to scrub the tires as much as I possibly could. You get round to the grid, you know, all the team are back out doing final checks, and there's a big crew of cameras and people wandering around. And then everyone just disappears, and there's this crazy moment of silence in your own mind where everything suddenly calms, and you know the race is about to start, and you can see them with the green flags at the back and front of the grid. So you're under starter's orders, and then there's a 30-second board, and the 10-second board, the 5-second board. You put the car in gear into first at the 10-second board. I'm sitting there kind of holding probably 2,000 RPM. The 5-second board comes out. Build the revs up to sort of 5,000 RPM. Yeah, again, I'm not going to let this one get away from me and bump the car away. And then it just worked like a dream. Her arm went up. I counted one. Just before I got to two in my mind, I just dropped the clutch and went. And it just coincided beautifully and got a really, really clean start. You know, if you watch the footage to this day, all the commentaries on Bill Shepherd, who was in third on the start and lit the car up, smoke, tire smoke everywhere. And then with Nicholas Minasan was in the Tejero on the inside, in the middle, actually. And going into Madrid, I had the lead into Madrid. And then in you know, Minasan in the Tejero, you know, much more skill than I've got, had the confidence to carry more speed round, and he got past me there. And then we're into the first lap of the race. And at that point, I said to myself, okay, I've just got to settle into this race. I know I'm quick. But the key thing here is to stay out of trouble, because it's so easy to get caught up in an instant in those first races, in those first few laps, because everyone around you is really hustling, really pushing, really trying to get ahead. They're all heavy cars, the maximum fuel's in at the moment, and the tires are at their coldest, and people are trying to find an advantage. And I knew most of the people around me were probably quicker drivers than I was. And you look through the list of people out there, and to this day, it's still astonishing who we're racing against. As I mentioned, there's Dumas, and there's Minasan, and there's Benoit Trullier, and there's Darren Turner out there, and Franchitti, and Pirro, and Chanduk, and you know, Brabham, and you know, Alex Brundle, and Tiff Nadell, and you know, Neil Yarny. Between these guys, Brendan Hartley, who was in you know, Formula One the year before, and before that was the Porsche Work Try winning Le Mans. You know, you've got so many people around you who you know are on a different planet, and really, I didn't feel I should be amongst them. So there's a sense of just, keep a calm head here. Keep a calm head. Don't get caught up in a needless fight. If someone looks like they're a bit racy or a bit quick or very aggressive, just let them through, because there's nothing to be gained by being a hero in these early couple of laps. I just needed to get settled in and build a consistent time. So yeah, the first few laps, I think I slipped back from pole to probably fourth in the first lap and then sixth. And then eventually I dropped, I think it was ninth place. But we're all still within you know, a close running, and it was finding a natural pace now. And now I knew who I was against. I could see I was getting into a bit of a race with Sean Lynn, who's got another wonderful, wonderful Le Mans Cobra. And we were having a great battle between the two of us. But again, I knew that Sean and I were always very close in times. And it was going to be for him to get past me if it's going to happen. And at this point, I wasn't going to just let anybody past unless I felt that they had to come past. And there was some attrition ahead of us and some attrition behind and dramas going on left, right, and center, as there always are in the TT. But now we've settled into a pace. We're in a good position. And I'm really conscious of waiting for that pit window to open, because I wanted to make an earlier pit, because clearly Andre's a faster driver than me. So the window opens at 20 minutes, then closes at 40 minutes. So we're looking to pit around about the 25-minute mark, something like that. So I was looking for the pit lane open box, and I was coming into Woodcock with Sean again right at the back of me, because I was struggling a bit out of Lavant corner, and I could see in my rear view mirror. And as I came into Woodcock and just set the car up and turned the car in, I just saw him sailing past on the outside, and I thought, that's a bit quick. That's not going to work. And out of my corner of my eye, I saw the car spear off to the side. And I just looked up on one of the big star screens there and saw it gone heavily into the barriers on the outside of the track. And I just, maybe it's years of going to Goodwood, years of watching the races, being in the races, but everything told me that's going to be a safety car. And you know, you can't do a driver change under safety car at Goodwood. But if you get one in beforehand, you're in luck. And as I came through and looked at the chicane ahead of me, I could see up ahead that the pit window open board had just gone out. And so I just shot straight into the pit. As you know, they hadn't yet called a safety car. The yellow flag has only just gone out. Got into the pits. Andre is already waiting for me there. Did the driver change. He got out. And there were probably five of us. In fairness, all the front runners had done the same thing. They'd all come in that first pit stop and got in. And then inevitably there, the safety car was called. So nobody else could get into the pit. And one of the cars that couldn't pit was the Jadero in Minasan that had made a very strong start. And he's waiting to hand the car over to Oliver Hart. And they were now stuck out there, whereas the other cars, ourselves included, had managed to make that pit stop now. And yeah, I'd handed the car over to Andre, and he was back now in probably after the pit stop, maybe in maybe 9th, 10th, 11th place, something like that. But there were cars all bunched up behind the safety car now. And when the safety car came in, that's when the race just came alive, because you had all the front guys had made the driver changes. So, you know, Dumas was in the Bill Shepherd's Cobra at this point. Benoit Trullier had hopped into the Lister Jaguar. And we had obviously Lotterer was in my car, and Ollie Bryant had swapped with Darren Turner and was into his car, the Alaman car. And so the fast guys were now all in the cars generally, and it built into an incredible race, as you can see on TV if you watch the replays. And what was building in me, though, was a sense of, hang on a moment, we might actually do this, because the race has gone well. We're in a good position. The incident and the pit window has gone our way. Lotterer's now out and in the car. They've been bunched up, so any gap they had, probably sort of 5-6 seconds back down the tread, had been nullified. This might actually happen. We could be on for a Goodwood TT win. And as that second part of the race progressed, you know, the fast guys got to the front. It ended up with Dumas leading in the green Bill Shepherd car. I think that the car had been overdriven a little bit in the first part of the race, and that was starting to manifest itself later now, the tyres and brakes going off a little bit. And you could see from the in-car footage that Dumas was fighting the car quite hard. And Lotterer was just building in this wonderfully calm, aggressive and incisive and quick method, and then made a beautiful pass for the lead out of Fordwater. Flat chat, very fast, very dangerous part of the circuit. Took the lead, was just divine to watch through traffic, judgment of the spaces and the gaps he was taking. And he had the lead 17 minutes before the end. Those 17 minutes are etched in my memory now as probably the longest 17 minutes of my life. Yeah, they just seemed to drag by so slowly. And in the midst of the chaos and the busyness and the activity and the pit lane and from the pit wall, for me, time just seemed to slow down. I had my wife and my daughter with me. Lots of mates started to appear. Ian Gwynn, who was running the team for me, came over and joined in, and we're all starting to feel this sense of anxiety, nervousness, this sense of, look, this is really possible now. You know, Andre's clearly going to do the job. He's got the lead. There's no doubt that Dumas is struggling with the car. We just need now no incidents, no mechanical failures, all the kind of things that have tripped us up and tripped other people up in the past to come good and fall our way. And 17 minutes became 10 minutes, became 5 minutes. You know, a chap appeared with a camera on his shoulder and started loitering a few feet away, just filming me. You know, I knew what that was about. They love to get the reaction of the co-driver of the winning car. And my wife at that point sort of ducked away. She didn't want to be in it. And I was just suddenly sort of shrank into my own zone now, and it was just counting off the laps. And then when it got to the last lap and this incredible sense of my God, we've done it. And as Andre took the flag, the relief and the joy was just all that pent up anticipation and nerves just came flooding out. And it was an amazing moment, just hugging my family with friends, congratulations. And it was really probably suddenly confusion reigned, because everyone on the pit wall there wants to win that race, has put so much into it. And one was suddenly swamped with people, and there's huge camaraderie, and it was just for everybody, for the mechanics and for family and friends, just a huge occasion. So much so that I then lost all track of what was going on, and suddenly realized I had to get to the front and out to the start finish line, because they were starting to interview the drivers. They always interview the top three drivers in most races, and the TT, of course, had six people on the grid. I had to sort of get through a bit of a small media scrum, really, but you know, to the front to find Andre and to see Ed, who was doing the interviews, and then we were presented with our garlands and the famous Goodwood cigars. And I just remember standing in the sunlight on the start finish lane next to the car with Lotterer, looking at the crowds, offering a few words that I could, and chattering away. Couldn't really believe anything was happening. It didn't really sink in at that point. You then, after the race, you've got to clear reasonably quickly, because obviously there's more racing to be run that afternoon. But we kind of got back to the paddock area. Lotterer, Andre did the final sort of victory lap, no helmet on, just arm out the window, waving to the crowd. Brought the car in, and then we wheeled it through again, more people to get back into the paddock area, and backing the car in and pushing it in to its pit, and putting the two garlands on the windshield, and just again posing for photographs with friends and one thing and another. It was just this sense of literally walking on air, this happiness, this sense of being washed over with relief almost as well. And again, you just realize you're part of something really very big and very special. You know, at the end of the day, there's the final presentations, always held on the start-finish line on top of the pit building there. And sadly, Andre had to leave early to get back to Germany, because he was on the simulator for the Porsche Formula E project the following morning. So I got to take the honors of going up to be greeted by the Duke, as other winning drivers are, presented with our trophies and champagne and everything else, and in front of you know, the crowd and our participants. It's normally at the end of the day all the participants that are left on the track drinking champagne and really just toasting one another at the end of another great meeting. And this sense of suddenly now, almost for me, I suddenly felt I belong. I was no longer just someone who'd turned up and was taking part occasionally. I just suddenly felt for the first time this sense of belonging, and this is where I belong now. I feel like I'd earned that place, and suddenly felt at ease. A really nice footnote also to the presentations, actually, was as well as presenting all the various drivers of the races over the weekend, there's always at Goodwood a trophy for driver of the day, driver of the weekend. And it's presented to not necessarily a winning driver, but who the organisers and the Duke think is most deserving. And the driver of the weekend that year was Sam Hancock, who got presented with his trophy and a lovely Rolex watch by the Duke for his fabulous driving in the Sussex Trophy, I think it was, in a Ferrari 246 Dino, where he had a race-long battle for the lead with Roger Wills and a Lotus. And they were trading places and battling for the front. And the Lotus is a slipperier car, a bit faster. And Roger would pull out onto the straights. But back under the corners, Sam was heroic and sliding the Ferrari around, and probably made one of the overtakes of the weekend, I think, going into No Name and then into St. Mary's, where he went round the outside and then took the inside in this beautiful drift. But it was just, again, really, I don't know, it kind of brought things full circle to see Sam get driver of the weekend. So I felt as a team, myself, Andre, Sam, Ian Gwynn, you know, Chris and Paul, the main mechanics in the car, my family, we'd all come together, and everyone had invested so much in this, and we'd got the result. Following that, of course, you know, eventually you leave the circuit and it's back into the real world and life takes over again. And I think what's settles on me now, you know, some 6 months later, just looking back on that time, it's probably sunk in by now, and I often let my mind drift back to it. is really a sense of ease. I just think if I look back, it was 21 years in total from 98 when I first went to Goodwood as a spectator to ultimately, you know, when we won the TT. That's a long time in life, full stop. And it's been a big part of my life to that journey all the way through. And I think as I sit here now, this year, 2020, is pretty much a scratch year, sadly, because of what's going on in the world at the moment. All events are cancelled, things are on hold, and there's more important things to worry about. And that gives me and others, I think, you know, pause to stop and reflect. And when I reflect on racing, which is just one of the things that I'm passionate about, and cars in general, I'm thinking about the future and what I want to do with it. It raises an interesting question. I'm not sure that I want to go back and try and compete at that level. I feel possibly at this stage, I've maybe had my Goodwood journey. I've taken it from literally one extreme to the very other. And looking back again now on last year, we all put so much into it. I get myself so wound up about racing. It consumes my life, consumes my thought processes. And last year we put everything in and the plan came together. But I look back and go, I'm not sure I want to drive that fast again. You know, I was right up there on the pace in a early 60s sports car, GT car, which when you look at a Cobra, you wouldn't want to have a big crash in one. You know, it's a big, powerful, and get it wrong, dangerous car. I feel maybe I've closed that chapter now. Maybe that's that box ticks. I don't feel now there's any more need to go back to Goodwood and try and better that, because I don't think, for me, you could. It was a sunny weekend, friends and family, superstar driver, live TV, best result you could possibly want. I feel that the monkey's off my back now. So I look back as a 21-year journey, which consumed a lot of time and effort and resources, I'm incredibly fond of all the memories. But I think now, you know, if and when I'm lucky enough to go back to Goodwood, it'll be just to participate and enjoy, or even just to spectate and watch, because for me, there's lots of other motoring adventures in life to go and enjoy, other, you know, competitions to take part in. I'm starting to enjoy more and more sharing the car and rallying, seeing different locations and countries. But, you know, I can't wait to go back to Goodwood. You know, this ramble has been my story from beginning to end of that chapter, which is, you know, of racing for me. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll be coming back with future episodes to cover other aspects of this great hobby. But otherwise, thanks again for listening to Messing in Cars. And bye for now.